The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Glad Tidings, your weekly roundup of all the latest Everton Football Club news from The Athletic, with me, Greg O'Keefe, and Paddy Boyland. And coming up today, cup dreams die, but not without a fight. Fitness update, mixed news on squad depth at Goodison, the rise and rise of Ben Godfrey, and fight for your right back. So it's been a quiet week, obviously, Pad. International break is upon us. No match preview this week, but some good Everton content on the site nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not entirely sure it's ever a quiet week. I don't know if I'd use that word necessarily. There's always stuff happening. There's always debate to be had. Yeah. And certainly if you look on Twitter, there's always a scapegoat to be found somewhere, isn't there, in the Everton squad with things maybe not going so well right now. But no, I've enjoyed getting into some features, looking at things that will crop up again over the summer, particularly with regards to Everton's right-back situation. And I also had a nice chat with Ben Godfrey the other day. So, yeah, not all bad, really, let's be honest.
Yeah, it gives us time, international break, some time to just kind of stretch and have a look at things from a different angle and do a little bit of further in-depth research. And I think what we found recently is we are able to produce a different type of piece. And anyway, you can subscribe to join us and read those pieces on The Athletic UK right now for a special price of just £3.99 a month for 6 months. And that's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/EvertonPod. Take advantage of this special 40% discount. Once again, that's theathletic.com/EvertonPod. So it was kind of the most likely outcome in the end, with no less than 10 minutes on the clock. Nevertheless, we were still goalless with Manchester City, Pad. As we know, it didn't end quite as we wanted it to. However, there were some talking points and some positives in amongst it. I did a piece on Sunday afternoon, I don't know if you've read it yet, anyone, but about João Virginia and his reputation being, I'd say, significantly enhanced in that game. Now, this is somebody who you'd written about last year when he was on loan at Reading, pardon. We've both kept an eye on him, but you particularly with the 23s. And it was very promising what we saw from him in the game, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, to be honest, I think most of what he did against Burnley when he came off the bench after Pickford got injured, I think most of that was pretty good. Save for one moment where Ben Godfrey got in his way and it led to a very, very good chance for Matheus Vidra. I thought he was pretty much assured. And this was a continuation of that, but at a higher level and amplified. Really quite composed. Kicking a little bit at times left something to be desired. But on the whole, I think he can be very happy with the work he did against Manchester City. Big fear coming into this was that Everton were going into the game with the third choice keeper, a lad who was making his first start, as it happened, against Premier League opposition. And you wouldn't have been able to tell that. I don't think he looked assured. He looked like the kind of promising goalkeeper that Everton brought to the club from Arsenal a number of years ago. And I go back to last year in the conversations I had with people at Reading. What they said to me was, it felt a little bit early for him to be the regular choice week in, week out in the Championship, particularly with Reading battling relegation. But one person I spoke to said that he had special traits, things that could be worked on over time, and things that had brought him to the attention of Everton in the first place. So I thought he was really quite good against Manchester City, a bright point amid the disappointment.
Yeah.
And I know you spoke to Hugo Oliveira, didn't you, about him, and kind of he had positive things to say too.
Yeah, just about his maturity and his calmness, and in sense of that, instilling that calm into the defence in front of him. Obviously, Hugo worked at Benfica before moving on with Marco Silva to Watford and then ultimately Everton. But while he was at Benfica, he worked with some of the best in the game at the moment. You know, he helped when he was at the academy in the unit, the goalkeeping unit at the academy there, which was known as Eagle One, rather dramatically.
Sounds like an American kind of camp, doesn't it? Really?
It does, doesn't it? and so they, you know, some really special goalkeeping talents passed through that when Hugo was there, such as, you know, Jan Oblak and Ederson. And so to see that they were speaking extremely highly of Virginia even back then hints at the ability and the potential they saw. And of course, he went to Arsenal and then Everton. So it's no surprise that I think that he's rated, but me included, a lot of people maybe felt that when Reading didn't work out, without knowing the ins and outs of it, maybe if the feeling was that he just wasn't going to quite be of the grade. But no, I think he proved a lot of people wrong, and he had a solid game. In central defence, obviously, it did help that he wasn't an issue, which was great, really, because he was third choice. And defensively, I don't think there were too many things to complain about. It was a shock to see Michael Keane benched. Yerry Mina came back in. But Mina was very, very strong. You can talk about the second goal. But overall, I thought it was a decent display.
Yeah, from him. Mina coming back in for Michael Keane was a little bit of a surprise, yeah, as you mentioned. That being said, the suggestion from Ancelotti afterwards that he wants to keep people fresh and he wanted to reintegrate Yerry after that injury, I think he slotted back in pretty seamlessly, if I'm honest. And part of the thinking Ancelotti said was that they were trying to be extra aggressive, extra physical, and effectively seize their moment in the attack, particularly from set pieces and crosses and stuff like that. Well, actually, the best chance of the first half, for my money, went to Yerry Mina.
Yeah.
With the header that was cleared off the line by Zinchenko.
Yeah.
And I know there's been quite a lot of discussion outside of the blue half of Merseyside about Everton's blueprint against City on Saturday, whether it was maybe overly defensive and stuff like that. Well, you've only got to look at the stats at half-time and the opportunities that presented. City had all of the ball, but Everton had the best chance of the game, and I think it was four shots in the City box to just one in our area. Now that paints a picture of a blueprint that at that moment in time, certainly 45, 60, 75 minutes, that blueprint was working, and they've managed to limit a Manchester City side that has been pretty much all conquering, if we're being honest, for most of this season. I think it was just a case of tired legs and tired minds and that bit of extra quality from the bench that City were able to call on.
Yeah. I mean,
it's ludicrous, isn't it? It's ludicrous. They brought on Kevin De Bruyne and Riyad Mahrez.
Exactly.
And we've got lads on the bench that haven't been offered new deals and are out of contract at the end of the season. And that's the disparity in resources, particularly with Everton's stretch with injuries. Just going back to Virginia, what I loved about him was that City's first big chance, in my opinion, fell to Raheem Sterling around the hour mark. Virginia hadn't had that much to do. He'd had to claim a few crosses and save pretty easy shots from distance. But when the big opportunity presented, he was switched on and he made that save. And actually, it was a difficult save, but he made it look relatively comfortable and tipped it round the post. So kudos to him for that. I think concentration at the top level with goalkeepers is something that's kind of underrated as a skill, and he did that relatively well. But I'll be honest, maybe it sounds a bit defeatist, but I can't really find much fault in Everton given what they had at the disposal on Saturday.
No, I would tend to agree with you. You know, with that in mind, I suppose, look, it was dismally disappointing to be out the cup and to have the acceptance and that horrible creeping sensation that there's another year without silverware. So it doesn't build confidence at all, but this one shouldn't quite shatter confidence either, should it?
I don't believe that's the case at all. And Ancelotti said afterwards that he felt like there was no regret, and that actually if there was regret, it should have been for the performances against Fulham and Burnley and Newcastle times two.
Spot on.
At the end of the season, when we count the points and it's the final reckoning, it's going to be those performances, I think, that come home to roost for Everton, not losing 2-0 in an FA Cup quarter-final against Manchester City. I know going an extra year without a trophy is symbolic. The fact that Everton now can no longer win anything this season is a big deal for fans, and of course it should be, but that was always going to be the most difficult draw that Everton could have had. It was always going to be a game, given the injuries, where Everton were going to be up against it. And actually, I think if they'd stuck to the guns in other matches, if they'd beaten Fulham, Burnley, Newcastle at least once, they'd be in a position now in the table where you'd look at them as realistic top four contenders, and maybe more than that, kind of favourites for that top four. So I don't think there can be too many regrets. I think the regrets will come in at the end of the season when they look back on those games against supposed lesser lights. And there's still an opportunity with 10 games to go to push on into Europe. So I don't think all's gone anyway.
No, I agree.
Hello, listeners. Sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
There are, you know, mounting concerns injury wise. We've got the confirmation since we last spoke, I think, that it looks like Abdoulaye Doucouré. I mean, he's coy on it, Ancelotti, and as might well he be, because, you know, you can't be 100% certain whether or not players can recover faster. But I think the default seems to be creeping up that it's going to be, we won't see him again this season. Or if we do, it might just be the last couple of games. Still might be important, but I think they're still trying to ascertain how bad the fracture was. He's certainly not able to bear any weight and he's in a boot. So that's a massive blow. But on the flip side, a player that we've spoken about endlessly and you've written a lot about, we heard the news that Jean-Philippe Gabamin is going to be, apparently, is going to be back after the international break. So whether he's going to be, I think it's more he's going to be back in full training. Maybe seeing him in the team for Palace might be a leap too far, but certainly he's going to be in contention soon.
Yeah, I think it would be a step too far to reintegrate him into first team action against Crystal Palace. He's been out since August 2019. So it's, 18 months?
Incredible.
And in his time at Everton in that 18-20 month period, however long it is, he's had 135 minutes of action. So the idea that he's going to come straight back in and be Everton's kind of solve-all solution, I think, is something we need to dispense with pretty urgently.
Yeah.
That being the shame about this is that without Doucouré, Everton lack legs in the midfield, and it means that they're forced into defending a little bit deeper. We saw that against Manchester City anyway. But I think on the whole, they're not able to play on the front foot the same way because the midfielders just can't get back. Gabamin, his movement, his athleticism would all come in useful in this scenario. I think he's probably the closest to a Doucouré replacement that you get in the current squad, even if there are differences. So we're going to have to bide our time. Everton have been really cautious with this. I spoke to Gabamin's personal trainer it was at the start of the year, and he'd worked with him up to around December time when he returned to England. And I mean, it's taken 3.5, nearly 4 months to get us from the period where he's doing individual work to being ready to go into contact training with the first team. That tells you everything you need to know. He is chomping at the bit to play. I know that for a fact, but it's all about making sure that he doesn't break down yet again. Because if he breaks down for what? Would that be the fourth time? if he breaks down for the fourth time, then it's going to be a really difficult road back. And that's a physical thing, but it's also a mental thing too.
I actually think your players often come back from long-term injuries, play a couple of games, and then have to sit out a couple of games as their body kind of readjusts and then throws up a few. issue. So if that happens, I don't think necessarily everyone's head should explode. But I would add the caveat that obviously all is every other time he's come back or has been about to come back, it's been a major, major setback. So if that were to happen again, and God forbid, really, really, this lad needs some, deserves some good fortune, then you really would be, you'd just be wondering whether or not it's better for all parties. But look, let's look on the positive side of things. He's a young guy. Yes, he hasn't played much at all, but if he can be of any influence in the running, then it'll be a welcome return. Because effectively, we haven't had him full stop. So eventually, he'll be an important addition in the midfield.
Just on that point, I remember writing about Andre Gomez's return at the Emirates, and he'd obviously been out for a good amount of time after that horrific tackle from Hyunmin Son at Goodison in, I think it was November of Silva's second year. And I was told that because he'd been injured and because he'd learned how to put his weight and load his weight in different parts of his body, that was putting different parts of his body under more strain. And therefore, he was almost going to be more susceptible to new injuries, different injuries. And I don't mean big ones. I mean more kind of muscular injuries, because he might just put a bit of extra weight on his left foot when he's exactly. when he's running or on his left quad, whatever it may be. So I think you're entirely right in pointing out that this is not going to be a linear process. There might well be a small setback here or there. But the main thing is that on the whole, the injury that he had, which was a tendon, an ankle tendon injury, and initially the quadriceps injury, the main thing is that those two things have adequately healed.
Definitely. And speaking of adequately healing, this is also time for James Rodriguez's calf to get not 99% or 90% or whatever, 80%, but to be 100% right and to stay right, because God knows we need him, don't we, as well in the running.
Yeah, I'm starting to feel really old now, and it's worth adding at this moment in time that I'm only 29.
Same age as James, isn't it?
It is, and I've got slight fears over hitting 30. That seems like a milestone that I really don't want in my life. But to see James Rodriguez on Twitch announcing to us all when he's going to be back, and then us having to report on that is quite a bizarre departure from the journalism career I expected. to be honest, the suggestion is that he would resume training this week, the week we're recording, and that he'd potentially be back for the game against Crystal Palace. That can't come soon enough, because when you look at Everton in possession, he's absolutely fundamental. He's integral to the process, not just in terms of creating goals and scoring goals, but further back in play. Sometimes when we do these match pieces after games, we'll show a player event map. So it'll be everything, every kind of action from a player, tackles, passes, interceptions, all those kinds of things over the course of a game. And whereas, say, for example, Gylfi Sigurdsson as a number 10 will just be in that space in front of the penalty area, and then there'll be a bit of stuff out wide on the right and the left where he's crossing the ball, James's event map is nearly always congested and concentrated around the centre circle and that kind of middle third of the pitch. He helps Everton progress the ball, he helps Everton build attacks. And he's also the main creator as well. So with that, there's such a reliance on him. There's an over-reliance on him. And he can't get back soon enough. Because, like I said, I think he's going to be pivotal in that final 10 games of the season if he can actually stay fit this time.
It is an over-reliance. I agree with that phrasing there. And I think it's something that needs to be addressed in the summer in the transfer window, to be honest. Speaking of building at the back, obviously, another, I would argue, faultless performance from the fantastic Ben Godfrey against City at Goodison on Saturday evening. You spoke to Ben yesterday while he was away on international duty. What day? I'm losing track of time, space and time. It's Wednesday, isn't it? Yeah, you spoke to him anyway in the last 24 hours. And tell us what he was saying about his time so far at Everton.
Yeah, I think he's one of those players that's more or less immediately struck up a bond with the supporters. If you could craft a kind of identikit Everton, modern Everton player, somebody who was going to be loved by the fans, I think he pretty much looked like Ben Godfrey at this moment in time. He's physical, he's aggressive. Everton supporters, as we know, love a crunching tackle. when they're at Goodison. But his attitude's spot on as well. He's spoken about being a leader, wanting to develop as a future leader at Everton and with England. I think he's been pretty much faultless since he came in. And obviously the caveat here is he's had to move around. He's had to play in different positions. When he's been at left back, we know he's not going to create like Luca Dean. Let's be honest, that's just not realistic. But a growing influence at centre back since he's moved there. And one of the first names on the team sheet for me, I think, is glass ceiling. Of all the Everton centre backs, his glass ceiling is the highest. And it may well be the highest by far, given the attributes he's got at his disposal at the age of just 23. So yeah, I spoke to him on Tuesday, I think it was, ahead of the UEFA Euro Under 21 Championships. He's going to assume a leadership role for England in that tournament. He's going to be vital to their hopes. And he was just, he started speaking about how much he loves responsibility, having that responsibility heaped on him, being a leader. It's kind of something that's followed him around throughout his career already. And it's something that he wants to continue to do further on in his career. So he spoke about that. And then I asked about Seamus Coleman and what he can take from Seamus. And by the sounds of it, Seamus is somebody he looks at quite a lot and looks to model bits of his leadership on. So it was good to chat to him. It was really good. It was nice to have that ahead of the Euros. It'll be interesting to see how he goes and how England go, because I think they've got an exciting crop of players. But also Tom Davis is in the picture as well. So there's a bit of Everton representation there. Something to keep us vaguely interested in football over the next few weeks.
Well, you mentioned there with obviously Godfrey being asked to deputise at left back at times in Luca Dean's absence anyway. But a bit more of a long-term issue with Seamus Coleman ages is the quandary of who's been deputising and what we have and don't have down the right. To that end, you and Mark Carey, one of our stats specialists, we looked into a piece about, you know, who we might look at to be the long-term successor to Seamus Coleman, in the same way as, you know, the issue we faced replacing Leighton Baines and addressed successfully back in 18 it was, you're right. Nevertheless, so you and Mark had a good chat about that, put your heads together and came up with some really interesting potential solutions, whether it's going to be another Norwich raid for Max Ahrens and how much we might have to pay for that. So at this point, I think we'll introduce Mark, get a debut on the podcast and ask what he made of that search.
Hi guys, yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, we spoke about it at length, didn't we, Paddy, of the criteria, I guess, of exactly who would be best suited to I guess fill the big shoes of Seamus Coleman over a long period. It's hard to really just come straight in and fill those shoes. But you want someone, I guess, who is, you know, up and down that right hand side and more adept at running and carrying the ball more so than actually looking for a pass that's actually going to be maybe a progressive pass, is getting up and down that wing. And yeah, Max Ahrens was one who came out really strongly, obviously someone who's had experience with the Premier League themselves. And yes, Norwich didn't do very well last season, but they've been really strong this season, obviously going to come straight back up to the Premier League by the looks of it. And he's been doing really well. I think people have, you know, given him rave reviews, but I think that they've sort of used the fact that he hasn't had any assists as a bit of a stick to beat him with, because you know, it's very easy to say that, but the actual performances that he's provided and the chances that he's actually created actually suggest that he's far more creative than those assists suggest. So he'd be a really good shout. And you know, he's 21. I mean, if you were to get him, then he's someone who could be similar to Coleman in the right back position for many, many years. So he's a really key one. I mean, would the Everton fans want him?
It's a good question, Pad. What do you think? Does he fit the bill?
It was funny, actually, the other day. He's obviously quite close to Ben Godfrey, and he posted an image on Twitter in the England camp. They were both in train, and they both had their blue on, their blue England jerseys. And it's Max Ahrens and Ben Godfrey looking like they're doing a bit of football tennis, something like that. Click on that, and then look at the comments beneath And because he's a Norwich player, you'd expect most of the comments to be from Norwich supporters. But it's just a sea of Everton fans just saying, come to Everton, come to Everton, come to Goodison. Agent Ben Godfrey this, Agent Ben Godfrey that, doing the Lord's work. And people are not religious saying that, so that baffled me. But it's quite funny to see that. So I guess that gives you some indication, certainly to what Everton Twitter thinks, if you can call them one homogenous group. For me personally, and Mark's touched on this before, I think the key thing to stress is that Everton are looking for different things from the fullbacks. They're not looking for another version of Luca Dean, I don't think. I think what they want is probably going to be somebody who's more athletic, maybe a little bit more physical in some ways. We know Marcel Brands loves his physical metrics and running data. And effectively an upgrade in the long term on Seamus Coleman. And what I'd say is this does need to be, in my opinion, at least, a long-term successor. I don't really want to see a Florenzi or somebody like that who was suggested over the summer.
Luca Vasquez was linked, wasn't he? 29 years old.
Vasquez could be a decent short-term option, but what I would actually like to see is Seamus being there to nurture a much younger option so that Everton's future at right-back is more or less secured for 5, 6, 7 years. Somebody like Max Ahrens gives you that, but there are other players that do that as well. Does the fact that Max Ahrens has played with Ben Godfrey, does that count for him in terms of cohesion? Let's see over time. I'm pretty sure he'll be one that they're looking at. But there were other names mentioned in the piece, some of whom were almost entirely Mark's suggestion, came up on data searches, looking at the things we wanted to discuss: physicality, aggression, ability to carry the ball up the pitch and move well in possession. So Tariq Lamptey was one from Brighton that kind of showed up quite well in the stats, I think, Mark.
Yeah, he did show up quite well in the stats. I think the fact that Brighton play in a back three as well might be something where, I know that Everton have played in back three before, but it's something which may work against him slightly in that he's you know, it might take a bit of time to get used to that sort of system, but he's someone, again, who, you know, buzzes up and down that right-hand side. So he'd certainly be with a shout, and I think he's 20 years old as well. So it goes again that he's someone who could be filled that position for a number of years. I mean, one which I thought was, it's not really an outside shout because he plays for an established team in Wolfsburg, but one that I enjoyed looking at and sort of profiling statistically was someone called Kevin Mbabu, who's 25 years old, plays for Wolfsburg at right back. And Wolfsburg are pushing for Champions League at the moment. I think they're third in the Bundesliga. And it's, you know, aside from the recent Chelsea signings, a lot of players who do come from the Bundesliga do tend to do quite well in the Premier League because they've got a similar sort of league style and league strength. So in terms of fitting in, he could, you know, you'd imagine that he'd be able to fit in quite seamlessly into that league first and foremost. And he has had a brief spell at Newcastle in the past as well. So potentially just used to English.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I always love a random Bundesliga name because, as you say, they do. It is one of those leagues where you can often see that there's a correlation with the sort of pace, I think, of it and the physicality of it. So not quite the Premier League, but you can see that there are some sort of translatables. We won't be able to get into great detail on all the options, but there are about five or six players that you guys are considering in the article. I really do recommend that you go and read it because it's fascinating. But Mark, I want to know about the graphs in the article reminiscent of Pro Evo Soccer.
Well, yes. Yeah, so we use Smarter Scout to use our sort of statistical profiling of players, and we find it really useful to just look at a glance. There's a whole selection of different stylistic attributes that each player has, and it is just something to look at a glance and just see. Basically, the more colour that you have on a certain we call them pizza charts. So the more colour you have on a slice of the pizza chart, the more that player either does a certain given action or, you know, is quite adept or quite capable of this certain action. So, if you to really boil it down to simple terms, it's the more colour, the better. But yeah, I mean, you'll see it on, if for those who have read it and anyone who hasn't, we encourage you to do so. But there's yeah, there's each of the players that we look at, they have those different stylistic attributes, but a lot of them have that same theme running through of a high carry and dribble volume. So how much they actually look to move with the ball and progress with the ball. And almost all of them, I think, are pretty high on that. So it was a key criteria that Paddy and I wanted to make sure that we have when we're looking at similar sort of players to Coleman, but you know, different enough that they can offer something different for the next few years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of the names that you mentioned are going to be hotly contested signatures, and certainly in Lamptey and Ahrens's position. But I do must admit, it did whet my appetite to the thought of seeing either of those two. And then again, intrigued by the likes of Mbabu and some of the other players. So really interesting reading. And thanks for helping us with that, Mark. While we've got you as well, you did a piece, was it a fortnight ago? Where you basically did a rundown on the permutations for the top four. Now, Everton were kind of in the race to a degree at that point, and arguably it's really straining it to suggest they still are in the race. However, as Paddy and I were saying before we started recording, we still got that game in hand. What do you remind us what you sort of made of Everton's credentials as it was?
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose I should caveat this by saying that it is all driven by the numbers, and I'm not giving my personal opinion here, because it doesn't make for great reading, I guess, for Everton in terms of what we typically do in terms of looking at teams' underlying numbers is look at their expected goals for and against. So put simply, what are the quality of the chances they're creating and conceding on average? And for Everton, their expected goals for was 1.2 per game. So they're creating just over a goal's worth of sort of quality chances per game, which is actually the 12th best in the league. So pretty below where the sort of league position is. And looking at expected goals against, so with the sort of quality of chances they're conceding, on average is 1.3 per game. So they're actually conceding more chances and quality chances than they are actually looking to create. And that's the 14th best in the league in terms of that. So overall, they're sort of hovering around 12th in terms of expected goal difference, which is just a useful proxy to see, you know, underlying numbers where the team sort of should be based on the quality of those chances. And they're obviously the real league position is because sometimes teams outperform or underperform those actual positions. So of course it's going to be, you know, less representative than the league position, but it's a good proxy and a good idea of gives a good idea of where teams potentially should be if things were to play out over a longer period. So it may suggest Everton are in a slightly false position, but you know, they're having a great season overall, and you just think that can they just maybe ride their luck just for a little bit longer? I mean, something I thought of in terms of their expected goals difference and the chances that they are giving up, and I'd be interested to get your thoughts on it, are that I think sometimes when they go ahead, they're more likely to sit on the lead and then allow those chances maybe to be created, but they're more content to protect the lead rather than go ahead and create more chances. So I think it's, you know, the context there is that it might be slightly skewed by that once they've taken the lead, they're more likely to protect it. Would that be a fair statement?
I would completely agree with that. You look at the way possession stats fall after Everton take a lead in games, and it does show you that they're quite adept at holding on to an advantage, but they're really not good at chasing when they go behind. Their record when they go behind in games is quite poor, really, by any side standard, particularly one that supposedly has aspirations of being in the top four. So I do believe there's something in that. I also think the other thing is they've effectively been carving out, and the data shows this, one big chance a game. And inevitably, it's a really quality cross from a Hammers, Sigurdsson, Luca Dean to Calvert-Lewin, which is almost always dispatched at this moment in time. They're not creating more than that, and that's why I think it's hard for Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin to both go on scoring runs at the same time. But then the fact that they've got Hammers kind of supersedes some of this data, if that makes sense. And I realise you're a data analyst, so I shouldn't be saying this, but I think almost Hammers-Rodriguez is a cheat code. He's the guy that will probably score you 0.1 chance a game. And I think that makes a big, big difference to Everton. So I don't know if you agree with that, Mark.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is something where, I mean, yes, I'm a data analyst, but I'm not purely a data analyst. I'm also a football fan. So I always like to give a bit of a, you know, an opinion and a context around it as well. And you're absolutely right, because a lot of the data that we look through and things like expected goals are based on the average player. And it's fair to say that James Rodriguez is not your average player. He's above average. So he's likely to overperform and do a little bit better than what you'd expect, I suppose. And he's got that long range shot in his locker, and he's able to carve things out that maybe other people won't. So yeah, I definitely think that is true for certain players, for sure. I think that, yeah, maybe teams have looked to try and either, I guess, stop the provision of the balls into Calvert-Lewin, because I've looked at the shot map of Calvert-Lewin, and he exclusively scores within the box. I mean, that's not a surprise, right? But in terms of just trying to stop the balls into the box, or just look to just stop Calvert-Lewin getting a touch within the box, then maybe teams have started to work that out, because he had such a great start to the season that maybe that's also looking to stop him there. But yeah, the likes of Calvert-Lewin, Richarlison, James Rodriguez, you've got players who can win you games that sort of defy the data in many ways.
I like it, defying the data. We seem to do a lot of that.
The other thing there, Mark, is that we're talking almost exclusively about crosses. When you look at that, I've seen the same map you're talking about with Calvert-Lewin. And not only is it almost exclusively in the box, but it's mainly six-yard box. If we're being on a central six-yard box. And I think what's happened is, if Everton haven't got aerial dominance, if they're not winning those confrontations in the air, they really are struggling to carve out much else from open play. And I think that's where James being fit and available in that final 10 games of the season really is important, because they need to find new ways of attacking. They can't always just hope to prey on a set piece or a cross. There needs to be stuff from open play. They need to slide balls through the defence. They need different ways to attack. And the shame for me so far this season has been that in the early parts of the season they were doing that stuff. Look back on the game against West Brom, Brighton at home, even Crystal Palace away. And it's lovely free-flowing football where you've got the fullbacks bombing on, James picking up pockets of space, crosses coming into the box, but loads of different avenues to attack. And I think that's really difficult to defend against. But when James is not there, I think there's such a reliance on that left-hand side. We've already spoken about the need for reinforcements on the right. So if the threat's coming from one position and you more or less know where the ball is going to go, that makes it much easier for sides, particularly Burnley, Newcastle, teams that are adept at defending crosses normally in the box. I think it makes it much easier for them to come away from Goodison in particular points. So I think this just helps to explain why Everton have been so poor at Goodison this year.
Absolutely. Interesting stuff. Mark, thank you ever so much for coming on. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Hopefully we'll get you on in future to talk about breaking down the numbers when we have got Max Ahrens or Tariq Lamptey, see how they're adjusting to Goodison Park. So with no games this weekend, what we are going to do is a mailbag next week. I don't know if you remember those in the site. We've not done one for a while, but basically we'll answer your questions. So whatever it is, get your questions into us on Twitter. Use the hashtag glad tidings, GWLAD tidings, TADINGS. And we'll pick the best ones and have a look at answering them next week. Thanks again to Mark, and as ever to Paddy for listening and for joining in rather. And thank you for listening. We'll be back, as I say, next week with plenty more to talk about ahead of the important resumption of our fight for the top six, should we say?
Yeah, let's go with that.
That'll do.
The Athletic.